Community Conversations with Community Centres SA. Here's Kerry Ackermans.
Today on Community Conversations, we speak to Professor Lydia Woodyard from the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University. Community centres in particular are seeing many people present with mental health, and this is an opportunity to be able to hear from Lydia about the programs that they can provide to help your team triage when you have people coming from community who really need our help, but it's difficult to do that in the resources, time and constraints that you have in a community centre. Well, welcome to Community Conversations, Lydia. As one of the developers and teachers in the Flinders Certificates in Mental Health and Wellbeing for Workplaces and Communities, you have a lot of expertise in this space of mental health. And when we were chatting, I was saying to you that part of our issues that community centres are facing is that more than ever, they're having people present with more complex mental health issues and they're already under pressure. And so dealing with those is very challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's not just community centres. We're seeing it around the community in the people I like to call frontline mental health workers. That is, you know, customer call centre workers, people working in shops, managers, parents, hairdressers. You know, as the challenges in our community grow, the pressure builds on every single one of us when we're dealing with and supporting the people that are around us.
So, Lydia, you've obviously been involved in this very much from an academic perspective, but you've done a lot of corporate work as well. Can you talk through what people are seeing out there and why they're looking for help?
I guess we've got a number of issues across our society that have really been having a big impact on people's wellbeing. And of course, the main one that most people will think about is the cost of living. You know, we have challenges across housing and cost of living rises that are really having an impact on the wellbeing of the population. We know this from a whole range of research, and this is something that's really concerning to Australians. So Flinders did a big survey looking at wicked problems, and that, of course, is one of the issues that's really front of mind for Australians. But there are other issues. You know, we've got issues in our relationships with young people experiencing loneliness at the highest rates they ever have. All sorts of concerns that impact on the well-being of people. And of course, these things aren't isolated. They actually interact with each other, right? So people who might normally experience risks of mental health concerns, when experiencing, you know, increased pressure at work, increased pressure around cost of living, increased pressure about the housing situation, that obviously has impacts on their relationships and the communities around them. So these things kind of can cascade into multiple areas of our lives. And of course, there are some people that are particularly at risk, you know, who also are experiencing on top of that racism or prejudice and discrimination, issues around disability and healthcare access, and a whole range of other complex social issues that kind of make these circumstances particularly painful for some people.
Lydia, is there an aspect to this that is because we've moved so much to online communication? Is it the cause of what we're seeing, or can it be the help as well?
I think the answer is yes and yes, right? So we know that actually online communication can be a barrier, and spending lots of time, especially doom scrolling on the social medias, is not really the best thing that we can do for our mental health. And there's lots of research that's kind of suggesting that's the case. But it's not just that, right? It's also, there are situations where people are using online relationships really effectively to get them the help they need, to connect with others who are like-minded. So it's not an all or nothing thing when it comes to online and electronic lives, but loneliness is a growing issue, especially for young people.
Lydia, the university has done a lot of work in this space, as you say, and now you've actually pulled together a program where people don't need to have gone to a university and it's something that can help. Can you talk us through that?
Yeah, so we basically went out to all of our industry partners, so people from community centres, people from local government, big corporations, small businesses. And we said to them, what are the skills you wish that everyone working in your team or even volunteering in your context, you wish that they had when it came to mental health and wellbeing in your organisation, working with your customers, your clients or the community? With this idea that, okay, well, we can't actually meet the mental health and wellbeing needs of everyone in the community only through crisis support or clinical support. We actually need our whole population to have a bunch of skills. And so we went through this process of co-designing four topics that really anyone can take, and you can do them, you know, over a long period of time. And they're really focused on the skills and knowledges that, I guess, from my point of view, with, you know, over 15 years experience in this area, really wish that I, you know, even at the beginning, I wish someone had given me those four topics to take. The things that are really useful that we know are really important when you get out into the workplace, out into community groups. So basically those topics cover all the basic things that you need to know to understand a bit about mental health and wellbeing, your own, other people's. We have a topic that then covers how to develop your own mental health and wellbeing, one that looks at supporting others, and I always say it's from coaching conversations right through to critical incidents, how do we actually respond, and then one that specifically looks at leading organisations in workplace wellbeing. So they're kind of four topics that are focused on, like I said, those frontline workers, the everyone who has to deal with this stuff in every workplace, in every community group, whether that's a school or like a local sporting club or a community centre worker.
Lydia, just your comments that you've made then make me also think very much of our community centre workers and often for their volunteers as well, where they didn't sign up to experience these type of behaviours. And it's how they protect themselves, because if you work in community or you volunteer, you usually have a lot of empathy. And so for them, it's how do they not take this on? How do they protect themselves, have the empathy and still hold a space that can be helpful to the person who's come to the door?
Yeah, and that's a really key skill, right? Like, it's not something that is actually easy to develop, and we assume that empathy equips us for this work, but actually empathy can also be a barrier to this work. And understanding your own self and how it relates to helping others is actually a really key reflection part. So I think that this is one of the ways that we actually need to support volunteers in the work that they do, is helping them to understand a little bit about themselves and also how they can interact with and support others. And I think a big learning curve for anyone in this field is really thinking about, how can I help in the situation I'm in within my scope of practice? So that's a technical term we use a lot in social work or psychology to talk about the bits of the job that you're responsible for. Because if we take on the burden of every single person's every single problem, it really can lead to burnout. So understanding our scope of practice, which is, in my role, how can I help to make this a little bit better for this person? And that doesn't mean we can always fix the things. I mean, some of the issues we're talking about, they're really intractable problems. But that doesn't mean that in the middle of it, we can't help improve the situation or the circumstance of the particular person we're dealing with. But by understanding what our bit is, that allows us to do that bit safely and also to draw some boundaries for ourselves in terms of what we need to feel responsible for.
And do you think as well too, Lydia, it's very common, like we take the experience of grief and loss, which often can be a precursor to mental health because we don't address it well, particularly in Western society, is that people then think of the Me Too, or they think, oh, well, if I share a story about someone else who was worse off, the person will suddenly feel better.
It is a challenge, right? We always want to meet other people suffering in some way or make it better some way. I actually did a podcast just not long ago on this need we have to fix people's feelings of suffering. And that, of course, is a learning curve for anyone entering this kind of work or volunteering in this space. But actually what we do isn't, you know, often those kinds of actions, you know, we're trying to show empathy, or often we're trying to make ourselves feel better. We're trying to relieve our own distress in the face of other people's suffering. So being able to actually hear and hold that person's distress without feeling like we even have to fix it. We have to kind of, you know, share our personal stories or show that we understand, because often we try and do that in a way that actually gets it wrong, right?
Mm.
So, it comes across as placating or downplaying, or actually we think we're understanding, but we, you know, give them an example that doesn't quite fit at all, and they know that.
And it's everybody's idea, isn't it? Particularly when you take something like grief, whatever it is, someone feels
exactly.
They've got a worse story or another story. Oh, well, I heard the other day, and away they go and think that's going to make the person feel better.
That's right. Whereas actually what they need is our active presence, right? So actually just listening and letting them speak and learning some basic skills around how to paraphrase back to someone what they're saying, how to validate. And when we say validate, we don't mean tell them their experience is real or true, but actually just echo back that we are understanding how they feel and that they're the kinds of range of experiences we have. And then also knowing how to refer onwards, right? So understanding that other people's distress isn't something you have to carry. Actually, by carrying their feelings, you know, we sometimes feel as empathetic people, we've got to carry their feelings, like that makes us a good person or that is helping them in some way. But we really have to challenge that and go, actually, me feeling bad because they feel bad doesn't help them at all. But what do I need to do? Well, I need to know how to respond to them in the moment that isn't condescending, that does validate their experience, but also directs them towards sources of support. So really educating ourselves on what are the two or three main support routes for people with mental health or wellbeing challenges in your community, and how can I easily refer them on And of course, again, this is a way we can support our volunteers if we're working within a community centre, is making sure that they have those things at their fingertips. Even getting them to practice having a few conversations like that, right? So it doesn't become weird or unnatural to refer someone to help. And I guess at the most extreme end, even knowing what to do if you're facing, you know, a suicide risk or a suicide threat, how do you have that conversation to actually ask how someone's doing and do something about it that's appropriate? So within each community centre, working on those processes, you know, even if you can put a little card in each of your staff and employee and volunteer hands that basically makes it simple for them to refer on and spend a session where you practice having those critical conversations so that when it happens, anyone can do it, because you never know who that critical conversation is going to come to.
So let's actually then just unpack that a bit if we can, because I really love these to be tips orientated in our podcast for our community centre members and their volunteers. Who would centres refer on, just broadly, and what would you put on that card?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good one. I think that it's useful to make it appropriate to the local community. So, for example, do you have, you know, local mental health services that you can refer to? Obviously, pointing people towards their GP is often a first step. But then you may also include like national helplines on particular issues. So there are a number of resources that are available out there, and being able to direct people onto that, it can be really, really key. And it's key not just for the person you're serving, but actually for the safety and care of your staff member or volunteer, right? That they actually feel safe then to do the work because we've given them a strategy that they can enact. And so depending on the community, that could be quite different.
Of course. And in terms of that support on the card, it's a bit, is it like a, I always think it's like that first aid thing, or when you look at CPR, what's
exactly.
That just most basic? What tips can you give around that? What's those basics? You exhibit someone experiencing mental health. How can you just initially deal with that, like a triage?
Yeah, I mean, so some of those things are, that we're looking for, what are we looking for? We're looking for heightened distress, anyone talking about any risk of self-harm, thoughts of suicide. One of the things that I look for, I'm an academic, so actually the context of my workplace is, you know, I'm often dealing with students. And I think this kind of applies to community roles as well, which is if you're looking at symptoms like low mood, depression, sleeplessness, people talking about the kinds of normal ups and downs, most of those can kind of rotate through, you know, over a week or two period. But when you might have someone presenting and this is an ongoing issue, so it goes on beyond that second week or two period, that's really when you want to start to make sure you refer on, unless it's heightened distress in the moment, right? And heightened distress in the moment or thoughts of suicide, then we refer on straight away. So these are kind of worth unpacking a little bit, you know, in our teams to go, wait, what are the things that we think we've got? Maybe there's even resources within the community centre that we can point towards people for low-level wellbeing concerns. You know, they're feeling lonely or they're isolated. Okay, what do we do there? Up to, you know, maybe you have a green, yellow, red kind of escalation process to, you know, the kinds of things where you refer on. For example, someone who's experiencing, been really feeling low for a couple of weeks and has come up maybe to a couple of programs, or up to a red, which might be urgent action. So when you're actually doing something that's more urgent to get direct intervention for the person.
Great advice. Thank you very much, Lydia. And something else I just wanted to discuss around this is just how serious some of these stories that we're starting to hear, and obviously not detail, but just broadly. So you mentioned about suicide, where community centres are getting messages from people just saying that they can't take it anymore, which is a huge thing to get on your phone as
absolutely.
A message. Or they may be seeing violent situations where a food truck comes to help everybody and someone literally has pulled the driver of the truck out and just grabbing all the food and everyone's just standing back not knowing what to do.
Yeah, I mean, and we're seeing this across a whole range of sectors, actually, this kind of escalation of violence, difficulties, especially, you know, across health services in terms of customer interactions. And so, you know, again, this is really one of the ways when we're thinking about, especially our volunteers, because they can be kind of employees but not employees, but thinking about them through a lens of how do we create a safe working environment for them. Now, from a psychosocial safety point of view, we can't make everything safe. Right? But, you know, the work we do is hard. When we're doing community work, it's hard work. There are things that happen that are really difficult. But we do have to think about what are the risks here for our staff and volunteers, and how do we work to support them and mitigate those risks, or allow for processes that will support them to be able to manage and recover from those risks if they occur. So I don't know how much our community centres are aware, but back in December last year, legislation rolled out in Australia that really makes every employer responsible for psychosocial hazards in the workplace and ensuring that our staff are safe. And I guess I just encourage people working out in community centres to just include your volunteers when you think about those processes, because we need to be thinking about them from a staff point of view. So that includes things like, how do we manage critical incidences? How do we manage threats of violence? But let's not forget our volunteers and our casuals and all of those people that do important work, because keeping them safe has to be our priority as well.
Great explanation. Thank you, Lydia. Really appreciate that. And of course, in hand with that safe working environment is that thought that you've got to put on that oxygen mask first, look after yourself before you can help anyone else. And secondly, not taking that home so it weighs you down until you develop your own mental health issues.
Exactly. And these are, and a lot of these are best developed through a process of learning, you know, adding to our understanding of these issues, but also then having time to reflect and discuss them with other people. Because, you know, I've studied lots of things myself, but actually a lot of this work for me, it was actually in the context of community work that you really start to test the edges of your knowledge and apply it to yourself. And that actually happens in mentoring conversations, you know, where you go, actually, this one's really affecting me. So I guess I'm encouraging your teams to not also carry this stuff alone. A lot of the research we have on wellbeing in the workplace says that it's not actually the stress of the work itself, it's the relationships around the work that make the difference. So coming back to our local teams, we can do a lot to protect the work of our staff by maintaining a culture of kindness and support and openness in our local teams and work groups, because actually we'll learn through that stuff together.
And this can be a change for a lot of corporations as well. I mean, just talking the other day, some people working in a call centre, debt collection, and they're having conversations they've never had before because of cost of living and hardship and homelessness. But at the end of the day, the bill has to be paid.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess this is a professional challenge for us when you want to help, but you also have to be part of a system or process. And so part of this comes back to that issue of scope of practice and really defining down for our staff, for our volunteers, what their role is and how they can be involved. And we can't fix every problem that, you know, a person comes to us with, as much as we wish that we could. But what we can do is go about work in a way that we talk about meeting their basic psychological needs. So sure, you may not be able to actually fix their housing situation, although it would be great if you can refer them to help for that. But even how we treat the people that we come into contact with, the way that we treat them as a respected human, meets their psychological need for belonging. So this need to be part of a community and to be respected and to be valued and to be, we call it psychological safety, right? Which is the feeling that our brain has when others see us as a good and appropriate group member or relationship partner. And so just those acts of inclusion, of care, of listening can have a positive impact. We talk about the psychological need for agency. So this is not about controlling all the circumstance, but it's about supporting people to have some understanding of their choices and options and to work through those choices and options, right? So one of the skills that we give people in our courses is really just really dealing with basic problem-solving skills and working through a problem-solving worksheet with somebody, right? It's not about the specific knowledge we have. It's actually about just helping them to understand and identify what the challenge is, what some of their options are, and how to move forward. So really simple skills, but what they do is they meet that psychological need for to have some agency, to have some autonomy in your decision making. And the final one is a sense of competence. So again, this is often breaking down processes and making them simpler. And I do think community centres and libraries have been a big part of this for a long time, you know, improving people's access to information, use of computers, but support for processes. And I know before I came into psychology, I was involved in community work and we were supporting a lot of refugees. And at that stage, I was dealing a lot with really kids of refugee families who were coming in, and a lot of what we were doing was really just helping them to understand basic processes around education, you know, rent forms, you know, all of those things to support autonomy and competency, right? So we don't have to have all the answers, but to the degree that we can support people's sense of belonging, sense of agency, having some choices, having some, you know, decisions to make for themselves, and competency by helping them step through and make things, small steps, small actions they can take, then we're actually supporting their overall mental health and well-being. So, you know, we don't have to fix every large problem to help the human in the middle of that problem.
That's a great, wonderful explanation of that, Lydia, because it's so true, and that's exactly what a community centre does. They don't have to fix the problem, but they always can give warm, welcome, safe space, inclusive space, and they can then refer on.
Exactly, exactly. And that stuff, in some ways, there's a really strong argument to be made that that is actually the biggest piece of the pie, that if we actually can feel connected to others, supported and loved in community, that that actually is the most important thing we can do.
Well, very proud to be involved with community centres doing that, and thrilled with an opportunity to speak to you today, Lydia Woodgate, because you've given some great advice and information. And how do we find out more about your program at Flinders? Because I'm sure there'll be a lot of people who are very interested.
Yeah, just go ahead and Google mental health and wellbeing at Flinders, and you'll find we've got a certificate for those who haven't done a degree before and a grad certificate for those who have. And if you've got any questions, there's some contact details and will likely come through to me. And you can also look out for us. I guess we've got an open day coming up, so come and see us in open day and we're happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Delightful to have you on the podcast today, Lydia.
Thanks for having me.
On behalf of all the Community Centres SA teams, thanks for listening. Feel free to get in touch with us at communitycentressa.asn.au. We'll be back next week. But wherever you are, at home, with your work and in your daily life, we hope that we have planted a seed to enable ongoing community conversations.
Community Conversations. For more information, check out communitycentressa.asn.au.